I am Wulfgar, son of Beornigar and king of the tribe of the Elk. Yet I speak to you now not as your king, but as a kindred warrior, horrified at the dishonor Heefstag tried to place upon us all. Spurred on by the knowledge that he had gained their attention and respect, and by the confirmation that his assumptions of their true desires had not been in error, Wulfgar seized the moment. These people had cried out for deliverance from the tyrannical reign of the One-Eyed King, and beaten almost to extinction in their last campaign, and now, about to fight beside goblins and giants, they longed for a hero to gain them back their lost pride. "I am the Dragon Slayer," he continued, "and by right of victory, I possess the treasures of Isengdeath." Again, the private conversations interrupted him, for the now unguarded treasure had become a subject for debate. Wulfgar let them continue their gossip for a long moment to heighten their interest in the dragon's gold. When they finally quieted, he went on. "The tribes of the tundra do not fight in a common cause with goblins and giants," he decreed to rousing shouts of approval. "We fight against them." The crowd suddenly hushed. A guard rushed into the tent, but did not dare interrupt the new king. "I leave with the dawn for 10 towns. Wulfgar stated. "I shall battle against the wizard Kessel and the foul horde he has pulled from the holes of the spine of the world." The crowd did not respond. They accepted the notion of battle against Kessel eagerly, but the thought of returning to 10 towns to help the people who had nearly destroyed them 5 years before had never occurred to them. But the guard now intervened. "I fear that your quest shall be in vain, young king," he said. Wulfgar turned a distressed eye upon the man, guessing the news he bore. "The smoke clouds from great fires are even now rising above the southern plain." Wulfgar considered the distressing news. He had thought that he would have more time. "Then I shall leave tonight," he roared at the stunned assembly. "Come with me, my friends, my fellow warriors of the north. I shall show you the path to the lost glories of our past." The crowd seemed torn and uncertain. Wulfgar played his final card. "To any man who will go with me, or to his surviving kin if he should fall, I offer an equal share of the dragon's treasure." He had swept in like a mighty squall off the sea of moving ice. He had captured the imagination and heart of every barbarian warrior and had promised them a return to the wealth and glory of their brightest days. That very night, Wulfgar's mercenary army charged out of their encampment and thundered across the open plain. Not a single man remained behind. 27. The Clock of Doom. Bremen was torched at dawn. The people of the small, unwalled village had known better than to stand and fight when the wave of monsters rolled across the Shaingarn River. They put up token resistance at the ford, firing a few bursts of arrows at the lead goblins just to slow the ranks long enough for the heaviest and slowest ships to clear the harbor and reach the safety of Mare Dualden. The archers then fled back to the docks and followed their fellow townsmen. When the goblins finally entered the city, they found it completely deserted. They watched angrily as the sailing ships moved back toward the east to join the flotilla of Targos and Tourmaline. Bremen was too far out of the way to be of any use to Akkar Kessel, so, unlike the city of Tourmaline, which had been converted into a camp, this city was burned to the ground. The people on the lake, the newest in the long line of homeless victims of Kessel's wanton destruction, watched helplessly as their homes fell in smoldering splinters. From the wall of Bryn Shander, Cassius and Regis watched too.
"He has made yet another mistake," Cassius told the halfling.
"How so?"
"Kessel has backed the people of Targos and Tourmaline, Kaer Koenig and Kaer Dinneval, and now Bremen into a corner," Cassius explained. "They have nowhere to go now. Their only hope lies in victory."
"Not much of a hope," Regis remarked. "You have seen what the tower can do, and even without it, Kessel's army could destroy us all. As he said, he holds every advantage."
Perhaps, Cassius conceded. The wizard believes that he is invincible, that much is certain. And that is his mistake, my friend. The meekest of animals will fight bravely when it is backed against a wall, for it has nothing to lose. A poor man is more deadly than a rich man because he puts less value on his own life. And a man stranded homeless on the frozen steppes, with the first winds of winter already beginning to blow, is a formidable enemy indeed. Fear not, little friend, Cassius continued. At our council this morning, we shall find a way to exploit the wizard's weaknesses. Regis nodded. Unable to dispute the spokesman's simple logic and unwilling to refute his optimism. Still, as he scanned the deep ranks of goblins and orcs that surrounded the city, the halfling held out little hope. He looked northward, where the dust had finally settled on the dwarven valley. Brunner's climb was no more, having toppled with the rest of the cliff face when the dwarves closed up their caverns.
"Open a door for me, Brunner," Regis whispered absently. "Please let me in."
Coincidentally, Brunner and his clan were, at that very moment, discussing the feasibility of opening a door in their tunnels, but not to let anyone in. Soon after their smashing success against the ogres and goblins on the ledges outside their mines, the fighting Longbeards had realized they could not sit idly by while orcs and goblins and even worse monsters destroyed the world around them. They were eager to take a second shot at Kessel. In their underground womb, they had no idea if Bryn Shander was still standing or if Kessel's army had already rolled over all of Ten Towns, but they could hear the sounds of an encampment above the southernmost sections of their huge complex. Brunner was the one who had proposed the idea of a second battle, mainly because of his own anger at the imminent loss of his closest non-dwarven friends. Shortly after the goblins that had escaped the tunnel collapse had been cut down, the leader of the clan from Mithril Hall gathered the whole of his people around him.
"Send someone to the farthest ends of the tunnels," he instructed. "Find out where the dogs will do their sleeping."
That night, the sounds of the marching monsters became obvious far in the south, under the fields surrounding Bryn Shander. The industrious dwarves immediately set about reconditioning the little-used tunnels that ran in that direction. And when they had gotten under the army, they dug 10 separate upward shafts, stopping just shy of the surface. A special gleam had returned to their eyes, the sparkle of a dwarf who knows that he's about to chop off a few goblin heads. Brunner's devious plan had endless potential for revenge with minimal risk. With 5 minutes' notice, they could complete their new exits. Less than a minute beyond that, their entire force would be up in the middle of Kessel's sleeping army. The meeting that Cassius had labeled a council was truly more of a forum where the spokesman from Bryn Shander could unveil his first retaliatory strategies. Yet none of the gathered leaders, even Glenn Sather, the only other spokesman in attendance, protested in the least. Cassius had studied every aspect of the entrenched goblin army and the wizard with meticulous attention to detail. The spokesman had outlined a layout of the entire force, detailing the most potentially explosive rivalries among the goblin and orc ranks and his best estimates about the length of time it would take for the inner fighting to sufficiently weaken the army. Everyone in attendance was agreed, though, that the cornerstone holding the siege together was Kryshal Tirith. The awesome power of the crystalline structure would cow even the most disruptive orcs into unquestioning obedience. Yet the limits of that power, as Cassius saw it, were the real issue.
"Why was Kessel so insistent on an immediate surrender?" the spokesman reasoned. "He could let us sit under the stress of a siege for a few days to soften our resistance."
The others agreed with the logic of Cassius's line of thinking, but had no answers for him.
"Perhaps Kessel does not command as strong a hold over his charges as we believe," Cassius himself proposed. "Might it be that the wizard fears his army will disintegrate around him if stalled for any length of time?"
"It might,"
replied Glenn Sather of East Haven, Or maybe Akar Kessel simply perceives the strength of his advantage and knows that we have no choice but to comply. Do you perhaps confuse confidence with concern?
Cassius paused for a moment to reflect on the question.
A point well taken, he said at length, yet immaterial to our plans.
Glenn Sather and several others cocked a curious eye at the spokesman.
We assume the latter, Cassius explained. If the wizard is truly in absolute control of the gathered army, then anything we might attempt shall prove futile in any case. Therefore, we must act on the assumption that Kessel's impatience reveals well-founded concern. I do not perceive the wizard as an exceptional strategist. He has embarked on a path of destruction that he assumed would cow us into submission, yet which, in reality, has actually strengthened the resolve of many of our people to fight to the last. Long-standing rivalries between several of the towns, bitterness that a wise leader of an invading force would surely have twisted into an excellent advantage, have been mended by Kessel's blatant disregard of finesse and his displays of outrageous brutality.
Cassius knew by the attentive looks he was receiving that he was gaining support from every corner. He was trying to accomplish two things in this meeting: to convince the others to go along with the gamble he was about to unveil, and to lift their outlook and give them back some shred of hope.
Our people are out there, he said, sweeping his arm in a wide arc. On Mare DeWalden and Lac Dinashir, the fleets have gathered, awaiting some sign from Bryn Shander that we shall support them. The people of Goodmead and Dugan's Hole do likewise on the southern lake, fully armed, and knowing full well that in this struggle there is nothing left at all for any survivors if we are not victorious.
He leaned forward over the table, alternately catching and holding the gaze of each man seated before him, and concluded grimly,
"No homes? No hope for our wives? No hope for our children? Nowhere left to run?"
Cassius continued to rally the others around him, and was soon backed by Glenn Sather, who had guessed at the spokesman's goal of increasing morale and recognized the value of it. Cassius searched for the most opportune moment. When the majority of the assembled leaders had replaced their frowns of despair with the determined grimace of survival, he put forth his daring plan.
"Kessel has demanded an emissary," he said, "and so we must deliver one."
"You or I would seem the most obvious choice," Glenn Sather intervened. "Which shall it be?"
A wry smile spread across Cassius's face.
"Neither," he replied. "One of us would be the obvious choice if we intended to go along with Kessel's demands. But we have one other option."
He turned his gaze squarely upon Regis. The halfling squirmed uncomfortably, half guessing what the spokesman had in mind.
"There is one among us who has attained an almost legendary reputation for his considerable abilities of persuasion. Perhaps his charismatic appeal shall win us some valuable time in our dealings with the wizard."
Regis felt ill. He had often wondered when the ruby pendant was going to get him into trouble too deep to climb out of. Several other people eyed Regis now, apparently intrigued by the potential of Cassius's suggestion. The stories of the halfling's charm and persuasive ability, and the accusation that Kemp had made at the council a few 10 days earlier, had been told and retold 1,000 times in every one of the towns, each storyteller typically enhancing and exaggerating the tales to increase his own importance. Though Regis hadn't been thrilled with losing the power of his secret, people seldom looked him straight in the eye anymore, he had come to enjoy a certain degree of fame. He hadn't considered the possible negative side effects of having so many people looking up to him.
"Let the halfling, the former spokesman from Lonelywood, represent us in Akar Kessel's court,"
Cassius declared to the nearly unanimous approval of the assembly.
"Perhaps our small friend will be able to convince the wizard of the error of his evil ways."
"You are mistaken," Regis protested. "They are only rumors."
"Humility," Cassius interrupted, "is a fine trait, good halfling. And all gathered here appreciate the sincerity of your self-doubts, and appreciate even more so your willingness to pit your talents against Kessel in the face of those self-doubts."
Regis closed his eyes and did not reply,
knowing that the motion would surely pass whether he approved or not. It did, without a single dissenting vote. The cornered people were quite willing to grab at any sliver of hope they could find. Cassius moved quickly to wrap up the council, for he believed that all other matters, problems of overcrowding and food hoarding, were of little importance at a time like this. If Regis failed, every other inconvenience would become immaterial. Regis remained silent. He had only attended the council to lend support to his spokesman friends. When he took his seat at the table, he had no intentions of even actively participating in the discussions, let alone becoming the focal point of the defense plan. And so the meeting adjourned. Cassius and Glenn Sather exchanged knowing winks of success, for everyone left the room feeling a bit more optimistic. Cassius held Regis back when he moved to leave with the others. The spokesman from Bryn Shander shut the door behind the last of them, desiring a private briefing with the principal character of the first stages of his plan.
"You could have spoken to me about all of this first," Regis grumbled at the spokesman's back as soon as the door was closed. "It seems only right that I should have been given the opportunity to make a decision in this matter."
Cassius wore a grim visage as he turned to face the halfling. "What choice do any of us have?" he asked. "At least this way, we have given them all some hope."
"You overestimate me," Regis protested.
"Perhaps you underestimate yourself," Cassius said. Though the halfling realized that Cassius would not back away from the plan he had set in motion, the spokesman's confidence relayed an altruistic spirit to Regis that was genuinely comforting.
"Let us pray, for both our sakes, that the latter is the truth," Cassius continued, moving to his seat at the table. "But I truly believe this to be the case. I have faith in you, even if you do not. I remember well what you did to Spokesman Kemp at the council 5 years ago, though it took his own declaration that he had been tricked to make me realize the truth of the situation. A masterful job of persuasion, Regis of Lonelywood, and more so because it held its secret for so long."
Regis blushed and conceded the point.
"And if you can deal with the stubborn likes of Kemp of Targos, you should find Akar Kessel easy prey." "I agree with your perceptions of Kessel as something less than a man of inner strength," said Regis. "But wizards have a way of uncovering wizard-like tricks. And you forget the demon. I would not even attempt to deceive one of its kind."
"Let us hope that you shall not have to deal with that one," Cassius agreed with a visible shudder.
"Yet I feel that you must go to the tower and try to dissuade the wizard. If we cannot somehow hold the gathered army at bay until its own inner turmoil becomes our ally, then we are surely doomed. Believe me, as I am your friend, that I would not ask you to journey into such peril if I saw any other possible path."
A pained look of helpless empathy had clearly worn through the spokesman's earlier facade of rousing optimism. His concern touched Regis, as would a starving man crying out for food. Even beyond his feelings for the overly pressured spokesman, Regis was forced to admit the logic of the plan and the absence of other avenues to explore. Kessel hadn't given them much time to regroup after the initial attack. In the raising of Targos, the wizard had demonstrated his ability to likewise destroy Bryn Shander, and the halfling had little doubt that Kessel would carry out his vile threat. So, Regis came to accept his role as their only option. The halfling wasn't easily spurred to action, but when he made up his mind to do something, he usually tried to do it properly.
"First of all," he began, "I must tell you in the strictest of confidence that I do indeed have magical aid."
A glimmer of hope returned to Cassius's eyes. He leaned forward, anxious to hear more, but Regis calmed him with an outstretched palm.
"You must understand, however," the halfling explained, "that I do not, as some tales claim, have the power to pervert what is in a person's heart. I could not convince Kessel to abandon his evil path any more than I could convince Spokesman Kemp to make peace with Tourmaline."
He rose from his cushioned chair and paced around the table, his hands clasped behind his back. Cassius watched him in uncertain anticipation. unable to figure out exactly what he was leading up to with his admission and then disclaimer of power.
Sometimes, though, I do have a way of making someone view his surroundings from a different perspective,
Regis admitted.
Like the incident you have referred to, when I convinced Kemp that embarking upon a certain preferable course of action would actually help him to achieve his own aspirations. So tell me again, Cassius, all that you have learned about the wizard and his army. Let us see if we might discover a way to make Kessel doubt the very things that he has come to rely upon.
The halfling's eloquence stunned the spokesman. Even though he hadn't looked Regis in the eye, he could see the promise of truth in the tales he had always presumed to be exaggerated. We know from the newsbearer that Kemp has taken command of the remaining forces of the four towns on Mare de Walden, Cassius explained. Likewise, Jensen Brent and Chairmont are poised upon Lac Dinashir, and combined with the fleets of Redwaters, they should prove a powerful force indeed. Kemp has already vowed revenge, and I doubt if any of the other refugees entertain thoughts of surrender or fleeing.
Where could they go?
Regis muttered. He looked pitifully at Cassius, who had no words of comfort. Cassius had put on a show of confidence and hope for the others at the council and for the people in the town, but he could not look at Regis now and make hollow promises. Glenn Sather suddenly burst back into the room.
The wizard is back on the field! He cried. He has demanded our emissary. The lights on the tower have started again.
The three rushed from the building, Cassius reiterating as much of the pertinent information as he could. Regis silenced him.
I am prepared, he assured Cassius. I don't know if this outrageous scheme of yours has any chance of working, but you have my vow that I'll work hard to carry out the deception.
Then they were at the gate. It must work, Cassius said, clapping Regis on the shoulder. We have no other hope. He started to turn away, but Regis had one final question that he needed answered.
If I find that Kessel is beyond my power, he asked grimly, what am I to do if the deception fails?
Cassius looked around at the thousands of women and children huddled against the chill wind in the city's common grounds. If it fails, he began slowly, if Kessel cannot be dissuaded from using the power of the tower against Bryn Shander, he paused again, if only to delay having to hear himself utter the words.
You are then under my personal orders to surrender the city.
Cassius turned away and headed for the parapets to witness the critical confrontation. Regis didn't hesitate any longer, for he knew that any pause at this frightening juncture would probably cause him to change his mind and run to find a hiding place in some dark hole in the city. Before he even had the chance to reconsider, he was through the gate and boldly marching down the hill toward the waiting specter of Akar Kessel. Kessel had again appeared between two mirrors borne by trolls, standing with arms crossed and one foot tapping impatiently. The evil scowl on his face gave Regis the distinct impression that the wizard, in a fit of uncontrollable rage, would strike him dead before he even reached the bottom of the hill. Yet the halfling had to keep his eyes focused on Kessel to even continue his approach. The wretched trolls disgusted and revulsed him beyond anything he had ever encountered, and it took all of his willpower to move anywhere near them. Even from the gate, he could smell the foul odor of their rotting stench. But somehow he made it to the mirrors and stood facing the evil wizard. Kessel studied the emissary for quite a while. He certainly hadn't expected a halfling to represent the city and wondered why Cassius hadn't come personally to such an important meeting.
Do you come before me as the official representative of Bryn Shander and all who now reside within her walls?
Regis nodded.
I am Regis of Lonelywood, he answered. A friend to Cassius and former member of the Council of Ten. I have been appointed to speak for the people within the city.
Kessel's eyes narrowed in anticipation of his victory.
And do you bear their message of unconditional surrender?
Regis shuffled uneasily, purposely shifting, so that the ruby pendant would start into motion on his chest.
"I desire private counsel with thee, mighty wizard, that we might discuss the terms of the agreement."
Cassel's eyes widened. He looked at Cassius upon the wall.
"I said unconditional!"
he shrieked. Behind him, the lights of Kryshal Tirith began to swirl and grow.
"Now you shall witness the folly of your insolence!"
"Wait!"
pleaded Regis, jumping around to regain the wizard's attention.
"There are some things that you should be aware of before all is decided."
Cassel paid little attention to the halfling's rambling, but the ruby pendant suddenly caught his attention. Even through the protection offered by the distance between his physical body and the window of his image projection, he found the gem fascinating. Regis couldn't resist the urge to smile, though only slightly, when he realized that the eyes of the wizard no longer blinked.
"I have some information that I am sure you will find valuable," the halfling said quietly.
Cassel signaled for him to continue.
"Not here," Regis whispered. "There are too many curious ears about. Not all of the gathered goblins would be pleased to hear what I have to say."
Cassel considered the halfling's words for a moment. He felt curiously subdued for some reason that he couldn't yet understand.
"Very well, halfling," he agreed. "I shall hear your words."
With a flash and a puff of smoke, the wizard was gone. Regis looked back over his shoulder at the people on the wall and nodded. Under telepathic command from within the tower, the trolls shifted the mirrors to catch Regis's reflection. A second flash and puff of smoke, and Regis, too, was gone. On the wall, Cassius returned the halfling's nod, though Regis had already disappeared. The spokesman breathed a bit easier, comforted by the last look Regis had thrown him and by the fact that the sun was setting and Bryn Shander still stood. If his guess, based on the timing of the wizard's actions, was correct, Kryshal Tirith drew most of its energy from the light of the sun. It appeared that his plan had bought them at least one more night. Even through his bleary eyes, Drizzt recognized the dark shape that hovered over him. The drow had banged his head when he had been thrown from the scimitar's hilt, and Guinevar, his loyal companion, had kept a silent vigil throughout the long hours the drow had remained unconscious, even though the cat had also been battered in the fight with Ertu. Drizzt rolled into a sitting position and tried to reorient himself to his surroundings. At first he thought that dawn had come, but then he realized that the dim sunlight was coming from the west. He had been out for the better part of a day, drained completely, for the scimitar had sapped his vital energy in its battle with the demon. Guinevar looked even more haggard. The cat's shoulder hung limp from its collision with the stone wall, and Ertu had torn a deep cut into one of its forelegs. More than injuries, though, fatigue was wearing on the magical beast. It had overstayed the normal limits of its visit to the material plane by many hours. The cord between its home plane and the drow's was only kept intact by the cat's own magical energy, and each passing minute that it remained in this world drew away a bit of its strength. Drizzt stroked the muscled neck tenderly. He understood the sacrifice Guinevar had made for his sake, and he wished that he could comply with the cat's needs and send it back to its own world. But he could not. If the cat returned to its own plane, it would be hours before it would regain the strength required to re-establish a link back to this world, and he needed the cat now. "A bit longer," he begged. The faithful beast lay down beside him without any hint of protest. Drizzt looked upon it with pity and petted the neck once again. How he longed to release the cat from his service, yet he could not. From what Ertu had told him, the door to Kryshal Tirith was invisible only to beings of the material plane. Drizzt needed the cat's eyes. 28. A Lie Within a Lie. Regis rubbed the afterimage of the blinding flash out of his eyes and found himself again facing the wizard. Kessel lounged on a crystal throne, leaning back against one of its arms with his legs casually thrown over the other. They were in a squared room of crystal, giving a slick visual impression, but feeling as solid as stone. Regis knew immediately that he was inside the tower. The room was filled with dozens of ornate and strangely shaped mirrors. One of these in particular, the largest and most decorative, caught the halfling's eye, for a fire was ablaze within its depths. At first, Regis looked opposite the mirror, expecting to see the source of the image. But then he realized that the flames were not a reflection, but an actual event occurring within the dimensions of the mirror itself.
"Welcome to my home," the wizard laughed. "You should consider yourself fortunate to witness its splendor."
But Regis fixed his gaze upon Kessel, studying the wizard closely, for the tone of his voice did not resemble the characteristic slur of others he had entranced with the ruby.
"You'll forgive my surprise when first we met," Kessel continued. "I did not expect the sturdy men of 10 towns to send a halfling to do their work."
He laughed again, and Regis knew that something had disrupted the charm he had cast upon the wizard when they were outside. The halfling could guess what had happened. He could feel the throbbing power of this room. It was evident that Kessel fed off of it. With his psyche outside, the wizard had been vulnerable to the magic of the gemstone, but in here, his strength was quite beyond the ruby's influence.
"You said that you had information to tell me," Kessel demanded suddenly. "Speak now, the whole of it, or I shall make your death an unpleasant one."
Regis stuttered, trying to improvise an alternative tale. The insidious lies he had planned to weave would have little value on the unaffected wizard. In fact, in their obvious weaknesses, they might reveal much of the truth about Cassius's strategies. Kessel straightened on his throne and leaned over the halfling, imposing his gaze upon his counterpart.
"Speak!"
he commanded evenly. Regis felt an iron will insinuating itself into all of his thoughts, compelling him to obey Kessel's every command. He sensed that the dominating force wasn't emanating from the wizard, though. Rather, it seemed to be coming from some external source, perhaps the unseen object that the wizard occasionally clutched in a pocket of his robes. Those of halfling stock possessed a strong natural resistance to such magic, however, and a countering force, the gemstone, helped Regis fight back against the insinuating will and gradually push it away. A sudden idea came over Regis. He had certainly seen enough individuals fall under his own charms to be able to imitate their revealing posture. He slouched a bit, as though he had suddenly been put completely at ease, and focused his blank stare on an image in the corner of the room beyond Kessel's shoulder. He felt his eyes drying out, but he resisted the temptation to blink.
"What information do you desire?"
he responded mechanically. Kessel slumped back again confidently.
"Address me as Master Kessel," he ordered.
"What information do you desire, Master Kessel?"
"Good," the wizard smirked to himself. "Admit the truth, halfling. The story you were sent to tell me was a deception."
Why not, Regis thought. A lie flavored with the sprinklings of truth becomes that much stronger.
"Yes,"
he answered.
"To make you think that your truest allies plotted against you."
"And what was the purpose?"
Kessel pressed, quite pleased with himself.
"Surely the people of Bryn Shander know that I could easily crush them, even without any allies at all. It seems a feeble plan to me."
"Cassius had no intentions of trying to defeat you, Master Kessel,"
Regis said.
"Then why are you here? And why didn't Cassius simply surrender the city as I demanded?"
"I was sent to plant some doubts,"
replied Regis, blindly improvising to keep Kessel intrigued and occupied. Behind the facade of his words, he was trying to put together some kind of an alternate plan.
"To give Cassius more time to lay out his true course of action."
Kessel leaned forward.
"And what might that course of action be?"
Regis paused, searching for an answer.
"You cannot resist me,"
Kessel roared.
My will is too great. Answer, or I shall tear the truth from your mind.
To escape,
Regis blurted. And after he had said it, several possibilities opened up before him. Kesso reclined again.
Impossible, he replied casually. My army is too strong at every point for the humans to break through.
Perhaps not as strong as you believe, Master Kessel, Regis baited.
His path now lay clear before him. A lie within another lie. He liked the formula.
Explain,
Kessel demanded, a shadow of worry clouding his cocky visage.
Cassius has allies within your ranks.
The wizard leaped from his chair, trembling in rage. Regis marveled at how effectively his simple imitation was working. He wondered for an instant if any of his own victims had likewise reversed the dupe on him. He put the disturbing thought away for future contemplation.
Orcs have lived among the people of Ten Towns for many months now, Regis went on. One tribe actually opened up a trading relationship with the fishermen. They too answered your summons to arms, but they still hold loyalties, if any of their kind ever truly hold loyalties, to Cassius. Even as your army was entrenching in the field around Bryn Shander, the first communications were exchanged between the orc chieftain and orc messengers that slipped out of Bryn Shander.
Kessel smoothed his hair back and rubbed his hand nervously across his face. Was it possible that his seemingly invincible army had a secret weakness? No, none would dare oppose Akkar Kessel. But still, if some of them were plotting against him, if all of them were plotting against him, would he know? And where was Ertu? Could the demon be behind this?
Which tribe?
He asked Regis softly, his tone revealing that the halfling's news had humbled him. Regis drew the wizard fully into the deception.
The group that you sent to sack the city of Bremen, the orcs of the Severed Tongue, he said,
watching the wizard's widening eyes with complete satisfaction.
My job was merely to prevent you from taking any action against Bryn Shander before the fall of night, for the orcs shall return before dawn, presumably to regroup in their assigned position on the field, but in actuality to open a gap in your western flank. Cassius will lead the people down the western slope to the open tundra. They only hope to keep you disorganized long enough to give them a solid lead. Then you shall be forced to pursue them all the way to Luskan.
Many weak points were apparent in the plan, but it seemed a reasonable gamble for people in such a desperate situation to attempt. Kessel slammed his fist down on the arm of the throne.
The fools! He growled.
Regis breathed a bit easier. Kessel was convinced.
Ertu!
He screamed suddenly, unaware that the demon had been banished from the world. There was no reply.
Oh, damn you, demon! Kessel cursed. You are never about when I need you most!
He spun on Regis.
You wait here. I shall have many more questions for you later.
The roaring fires of his anger simmered wickedly.
But first, I must speak with some of my generals. I shall teach the orcs of the Severed Tongue to oppose me!
In truth, the observations Cassius had made had labeled the orcs of the Severed Tongue as Kessel's strongest and most fanatical supporters. A lie within a lie. Out on the waters of Mare de Walden later that evening, the assembled fleet of the four towns watched suspiciously as a second group of monsters flowed out from the main force and headed in the direction of Bremen.
Curious!
Kemp remarked to Muldoon of Lonelywood and the spokesman from the burned city of Bremen, who were standing on the deck of Targos's flagship beside him. All of Bremen's populace was out on the lake. Certainly the first group of orcs, after the initial bow shots, had met no further resistance in the city, and Bryn Shander stood intact. Why, then, was the wizard further extending his line of power?
Akkar Kessel confuses me, said Muldoon. Either his genius is simply beyond me, or he truly makes glaring tactical errors. Assume the second possibility,
Kemp instructed hopefully. For anything that we might try shall be in vain if the first is the truth.
So they continued repositioning their warriors for an opportune strike, moving their children and womenfolk in the remaining boats to the as yet unassigned moorings of Lonelywood, similar to the strategies of the refugee forces on the other two lakes. On the wall of Bryn Shander, Cassius and Glensather watched the division of Kessel's forces with deeper understanding.
Masterfully done, halfling, Cassius whispered into the night wind.
Smiling, Glensather put a steadying hand on his fellow spokesman's shoulder.
I shall go and inform our field commanders, he said. If the time for us to attack comes, we shall be ready.
Cassius clasped Glensather's hand and nodded his approval. As the spokesman from Easthaven sped away, Cassius leaned upon the ridge of the wall, glaring determinedly at the now darkened walls of Kryshal Tirith. Through gritted teeth he declared openly,
The time shall come!
From the high vantage point of Kelvin's cairn, Drizzt Do'Urden had also witnessed the abrupt shift of the monster army. He had just completed the final preparations for his courageous assault on Kryshal Tirith when the distant flickers of a large mass of torches suddenly flowed away to the west. He and Guinevar sat quietly and studied the situation for a short while, trying to find some clue as to what had prompted such action. Nothing became apparent, but the night was growing long and he had to make haste. He wasn't sure if the activity would prove helpful, by thinning out the camp's ranks, or disruptive, by heightening the remaining monster's state of readiness. Yet he knew that the people of Bryn Shander could not afford any delays. He started down the mountain trail, the great panther trailing along silently behind him. He made the open ground in good time and started his hasty trot down the length of Bremen's Run. If he had paused to study his surroundings, or put one of his sensitive ears to the ground, he might have heard the distant rumble from the open tundra to the north of yet another approaching army. But the drow's focus was on the south, his vision narrowed upon the waiting darkness of Kryshal Tirith as he made haste. He was traveling light, carrying only items he believed essential to the task. He had his five weapons, the two scimitars sheathed in their leather scabbards on his hips, a dagger tucked in his belt at the middle of his back, and the two knives hidden in his boots. His holy symbol and pouch of wealth was around his neck, and a small sack of flour, left over from the raid on the giant's lair, still hung on his belt. A sentimental choice, a comforting reminder of the daring adventures he had shared with Wulfgar. All of his other supplies, backpack, rope, water skins, and other basic items of everyday survival on the harsh tundra, he had left in the small cubby. He heard the shouts of goblin merrymaking when he crossed by the eastern outskirts of Tourmaline. "Strike now, sailors of Mare de Walden," the drow said quietly. But when he thought about it, he was glad that the boats remained out on the lake. Even if they could slip in and strike quickly at the monsters in the city, they could not afford the losses they would suffer. Tourmaline could wait. There was a more important battle yet to be fought. Drizzt and Guinevar approached the outer perimeter of Kessel's main encampment. The drow was comforted by signs that the commotion within the camp had quieted. A solitary orc guard leaned wearily on its spear, half-heartedly watching the empty blackness of the northern horizon. Even had it been wary, it would not have noticed the stealthy approach of the two shapes, blacker than the darkness of night.
"Call in!" came a command from somewhere in the distance. "Clear!" replied the guard.
Drizzt listened as the check was called in from various distant spots. He signaled for Guinevar to hold back, then crept up within throwing range of the guard. The tired orc never even heard the whistle of the approaching dagger. And then Drizzt was beside it, silently breaking its fall into the darkness. The drow pulled his dagger from the orc's throat and laid his victim softly on the ground. He and Guinevar, unnoticed shadows of death, moved on. They had broken through the only line of guards that had been set on the northern perimeter, and now easily picked their way among the sleeping camp. Drizzt could have killed dozens of orcs and goblins, even a Verbeeg, though the cessation of its thundering snores might have drawn attention. But he couldn't afford to slow his pace. each passing minute continued to drain Guinevere, and now the first hints of a second enemy, the revealing dawn, were becoming apparent in the eastern sky. The drow's hopes had risen considerably with the progress he had made, but he was dismayed when he came upon Kryshal Tirith. A group of battle-ready ogre guards ringed the tower, blocking his way. He crouched beside the cat, undecided on what they should do. To escape the breadth of the huge camp before the dawn exposed them, they would have to flee back the way they came. Driz doubted that Guinevere, in its pitiful state, could even attempt that route. Yet to go on meant a hopeless fight with a group of ogres. There seemed no answer to the dilemma. Then something happened back in the northeast section of the encampment, opening a path for the stealthy companions. Sudden shouts of alarm sprang up, drawing the ogres a few long strides away from their posts. Driz thought at first that the murdered orc guard had been discovered, but the cries were too far to the east. Soon the clang of steel on steel rang out in the pre-dawn air. A battle had been joined. Rival tribes, Driz supposed, though he could not spot the combatants from the distance. His curiosity wasn't overwhelming, however. The undisciplined ogres had moved even farther away from their appointed positions, and Guinevere had spotted the tower door. The two didn't hesitate for a second. The ogres never even noticed the two shadows enter the tower behind them. A strange sensation, a buzzing vibration, came over Drizzt as he passed through Kryshal Tirith's entryway, as though he had moved into the bowels of a living entity. He continued on, though, through the darkened hallway that led to the tower's first level, marveling at the strange crystalline material that comprised the walls and floors of the structure. He found himself in a squared hall, the bottom chamber of the four-roomed structure. This was the hall where Kessel often met with his field generals, the wizard's primary audience hall for all but his top-ranking commanders. Driz peered around at the dark forms in the room and the deeper shadows that they created. Though he sighted no movement, he sensed that he was not alone. He knew that Guinevere had the same uneasy feelings, for the fur on the scruff of the black-coated neck was ruffled, and the cat let out a low growl. Kessel considered this room a buffer zone between himself and the rabble of the outside world. It was the one chamber in the tower that he rarely visited. This was the place where Akar Kessel housed his trolls. 29. Other Options. The dwarves of Mithril Hall completed the first of their secret exits shortly after sunset. Brunner was the first to climb to the top of the ladder and peek out from under the cut sod at the settling monster army. So expert were the dwarven miners that they had been able to dig a shaft right up into the middle of a large group of goblins and ogres without even alerting the monsters in the least. Brunner was smiling when he came back down to rejoin his clansmen.
"Finish the other nine," he instructed, as he moved down the tunnel, Catty Bree beside him. "Tonight's sleep will be a sound one for some of Kessel's boys," he declared, patting the head of his belted axe.
"What role am I to play in the coming battle?" Catty Bree asked when they moved away from the other dwarves.
"You'll get to pull one of the levers and collapse the tunnels if any of the swine come down," Brunner replied.
"And if you are all killed on the field," Catty Bree reasoned, "being buried alone in these tunnels does not hold much promise for me."
Brunner stroked his red beard. He hadn't considered that consequence, figuring only that if he and his clan were cut down on the field, Catty Bree would be safe enough behind the collapsed tunnels. But how could she live down here alone? What price would she pay for survival?
"Do you want to come up and fight, then? You're fair enough with a sword, and I'll be right beside ye."
Catty Bree considered the proposition for a moment.
"I'll stay with the lever," she decided. "You'll have enough to look after your own head up there. And someone has to be down here to drop the tunnels. We cannot let goblins claim our halls as their home. Besides," she added with a smile, "it was stupid of me to worry. I know that you will come back to me, Brunner. Never have you nor any of your clan failed me."
She kissed the dwarf on the forehead and skipped away. Brunner smiled after her.
"Sure, and you're a brave girl, my Catty Bree," he muttered.
The work on the tunnels was finished a few hours later. The shafts had been dug, and the entire tunnel complex around them had been rigged to collapse to cover any retreating action or squash any goblin advance. The entire clan, their faces purposely blackened with soot and their heavy armor and weapons muffled under layers of dark cloth, lined up at the base of the 10 shafts. Brunner went up first to investigate. He peeked out and smiled grimly. All around him, ogres and goblins had bedded down for the night. He was about to give the signal for his kinsmen to move when a commotion suddenly started up in the camp. Brunner remained at the top of the shaft, though he kept his head beneath the sod layer, which got him stepped on by a passing goblin, and tried to figure out what had alerted the monsters. He heard shouts of command and a clatter like a large force assembling. More shouts followed, calls for the death of the severed tongue. Though he had never heard that name before, the dwarf easily guessed that it described an orc tribe. "So they're fighting amongst themselves, are they?" he muttered softly, chuckling. Realizing that the dwarf's assault would have to wait, he climbed back down the ladder. But the clan, disappointed in the delay, did not disperse. They were determined that this night's work would indeed be done. So they waited. The night passed its midpoint, and still the sounds of movement came from the camp above. Yet the wait wasn't dulling the edge of the dwarves' determination. Conversely, the delay was sharpening their intensity, heightening their hunger for goblin blood. These fighters were also blacksmiths, craftsmen who spent long hours adding a single scale to a dragon statue. They knew patience. Finally, when all was quiet again, Brunner went back up the ladder. Before he had even poked his head through the turf, he heard the comforting sounds of rhythmic breathing and loud snores. Without further delay, the clan slipped out of the holes and methodically set about their murderous work. They did not revel in their roles as assassins, preferring to fight sword against sword, but they understood the necessity of this type of raid, and they placed no value whatsoever on the lives of goblin scum. The area gradually quieted as more and more of the monsters entered the silent sleep of death. The dwarves concentrated on the ogres first, in case their attack was discovered before they were able to do much damage. But their strategy was unnecessary. Many minutes passed without retaliation. By the time one of the guards noticed what was happening and managed to shout out a cry of alarm, the blood of more than 1,000 of Kessel's charges wetted the field. Cries went up all around them, but Brunner did not call for a retreat. "Form up," he commanded. "Tight around the tunnels." He knew that the mad rush of the first wave of counterattackers would be disorganized and unprepared. The dwarves formed into a tight defensive posture and had little trouble cutting the goblins down. Brunner's axe was marked with many more notches before any goblin had even taken a swing at him. Gradually, though, Kessel's charges became more organized. They came at the dwarves in formations of their own, and their growing numbers, as more and more of the camp was roused and alerted, began to press heavily on the raiders. And then a group of ogres, Kessel's elite tower guard, came charging across the field. The first of the dwarves to retreat, the tunnel experts, who were to make the final check on the preparations for the collapse, put their booted feet on the top rungs of the shaft ladders. The escape into the tunnels would be a delicate operation, and efficient haste would be the deciding factor in its success or failure. But Brunner unexpectedly ordered the tunnel experts to come back out of the shafts and the dwarves to hold their line. He had heard the first notes of an ancient song, a song that, just a few years before, would have filled him with dread. Now, though, it lifted his heart with hope. He recognized the voice that led the stirring words. A severed arm of rotted flesh splatted on the floor, yet another victim of the whirling scimitars of Drizzt D'Urden. But the fearless trolls crowded in. Normally, Drizzt would have known of their presence as soon as he entered the square chamber. Their terrible stench made it hard for them to hide. These ones, though, hadn't actually been in the chamber when the drow entered. As Drizzt had moved deeper into the room, he tripped a magical alarm that bathed the area in wizard's light and cued the guardians. They stepped in through the magical mirrors that Kessel had planted as watchposts throughout the room. Drizzt had already dropped one of the wretched beasts, but now he was more concerned with running than fighting. 5 others replaced the first and were more than a match for any fighter. Drizzt shook his head in disbelief when the body of the troll he had beheaded suddenly rose again and began flailing blindly. And then a clawed hand caught hold of his ankle. He knew without looking that it was the limb he had just cut free. Horrified, he kicked the grotesque arm away from him and turned and sprinted to the spiraling stairway that ran up to the tower's second level from the back of the chamber. At his earlier command, Guinevere had already limped weakly up the stairs and now waited on the platform at the top. Drizzt distinctly heard the sucking footsteps of his sickening pursuers and the scratching of the severed hand's filthy nails as it also took up the chase. The drow bounded up the stairway without looking back, hoping that his speed and agility would give him enough of a lead to find some way of escaping. For there was no door on the platform. The landing at the top of the stairs was rectangular and about 10 feet across at its widest length. Two sides were open to the room, a third caught the lip of the cresting stairwell, and the fourth was a flat sheet of mirror, extending the exact length of the platform and secured between it and the chamber's ceiling. Drizzt hoped that he would be able to understand the nuances of this unusual door, if that was what the mirror actually was, when he examined it from the platform's level. It wouldn't be that easy. Though the mirror was filled with the reflection of an ornate tapestry hanging on the wall of the chamber directly opposite it, its surface appeared perfectly smooth and unbroken by any cracks or handles that might indicate a concealed opening. Drizzt sheathed his weapons and ran his hands across the surface to see if there was a handle hidden from his sharp eyes, but the even glide of the glass only confirmed his observation. The trolls were on the stairway. Drizzt tried to push his way through the glass, speaking all of the command words of opening he had ever learned, searching for an extra-dimensional portal similar to the ones that had held Kessel's hideous guards. The wall remained a tangible barrier. The lead troll reached the halfway point on the stairs.
"There must be a clue somewhere," the drow groaned. "Wizards love a challenge, and there is no sport to this."
The only possible answer lay in the intricate designs and images of the tapestry. Drizzt stared at it, trying to sort through the thousands of interwoven images for some special hint that would show him the way to safety. The stench flowed up to him. He could hear the slobbering of the ever-hungry monsters. But he had to control his revulsion and concentrate on the myriad images. One thing in the tapestry caught his eye, the lines of a poem that wove through all of the other images along the top border. In contrast to the dulling colors of the rest of the ancient artwork, the calligraphed letters of the poem held the contrasting brightness of a newer addition, something Kessel had added. "Come, if ye will, to the orgy within. But first ye must find the latch, seen and not seen, been yet not been, and a handle that flesh cannot catch." One line in particular stood out in the drow's mind. He had heard the phrase, "been yet not been," in his childhood days in Menzo Berenzon. They referred to Urgutha Forca, a vicious demon that had ravaged the planet with a particularly virulent plague in the ancient times when Drizzt's ancestors had walked on the surface. The surface elves had always denied the existence of Urgutha Forca, blaming the plague on the drow, but the dark elves knew better. Something in their physical makeup had kept them immune to the demon, and after they realized how deadly it was to their enemies, they had worked to fulfill the suspicions of the light elves by enlisting Urgutha as an ally. Thus the reference, "been yet not been," was a derogatory line in a longer drow tale, a secret joke on their hated cousins, who had lost thousands to a creature they denied even existed. The riddle would have been impossible to anyone unaware of the tale of Urgutha Forca. The drow had found a valuable advantage. He scanned the reflection of the tapestry for some image that had a connection to the demon, and he found it on the far edge of the mirror at belt height. A portrayal of Urgutha itself, revealed in all of its horrible splendor. The demon was depicted smashing the skull of an elf with a black rod, its symbol. Drizzt had seen this same portrayal before. Nothing seemed out of place or hinted at anything unusual. The trolls had turned the final corner of their ascent. Drizzt was nearly out of time. He turned and searched the source of the image for some discrepancy. It struck him at once. In the original tapestry, Urgutha was striking the elf with his fist. There was no rod. Seen and not seen. Drizzt spun back on the mirror, grasping at the demon's illusory weapon. But all he felt was smooth glass. He nearly cried out in frustration. His experience had taught him discipline, and he quickly regained his composure. He moved his hand back away from the mirror, attempting to position his own reflection at the same depth he judged the rod to be at. He slowly closed his fingers, watching his hand's image close around the rod with the excitement of anticipated success. He shifted his hand slightly. A thin crack appeared in the mirror. The leading troll reached the top of the stairs, but Drizzt and Gwenivar were gone. The drow slid the strange door back into its closed position, leaned back, and sighed with relief. A dimly lit stairway led up before him, ending with a platform that opened into the